Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Gary Stoyer as he begins work as director of the City of Philadelphia's Office of Arts, Culture and the Creative Economy. David Patrick Stearns takes us to the Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Beethoven's Fidelio. We listen back to Jason Pfeiffer's feature on the DeMuth Foundation and Museum in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. The museum highlights the life and works of the early 20th century painter Charles DeMuth, a lifelong resident of Lancaster County. And Susan Lewis looks at jewellery crafted by sculptor and mobile artist Alexander Calder, now on exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
In July, Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter announced the appointment of Gary Stoyer as Chief Cultural Officer and Director of the City's Office of Arts, Culture and the Creative Economy. Stoyer, who began work this week, comes to Philadelphia from New York City, where his career evolved from theatre production and management to broader arts advocacy and policy making. For more than a decade, he ran the National Arts and Business Council, whose key operations continued after its 2005 measure with the arts advocacy group Americans for the Arts. For the last 3 years, he served as a vice president at Americans for the Arts, where his work included efforts to increase arts funding from the private sector. When we met at City Hall, I asked him what had convinced him to come to Philadelphia.
Well, I was already a big fan of Philadelphia, to be honest. I'd spent a lot of time here as a cultural tourist myself, as somebody sort of coming down on the train to spend some time here, to see shows, to go to the museums. I knew the city well and frankly had a sense that there were just great, exciting things happening here. I had a sense of, at least until our recent setbacks in the national economy, relatively speaking, a healthy local economy, a sense of really exciting arts activity that frankly went beyond the major institutions. I mean, most major cities have a major museum, they have a symphony orchestra, they have a ballet company, and Philly has all of that and extraordinary ones, but there's so much more. I mean, so many neighborhood-based arts organizations at the local level, so many sort of cutting-edge artists and small arts organizations in all disciplines, a growing, burgeoning world of individual artists who have moved here. So I think there's just a sense of so much in the way of cultural assets. And frankly, on top of that, you have probably a greater set of assets in the area of history than you have anywhere else in the country. And that, in my mind, that's really part of arts and culture as well. And that's another sort of world-class asset that the city has. So for me, it was just a really exciting opportunity that I had to take advantage of. And also, frankly, I had heard such great things about the new mayor, and he's a great salesperson too, and I really wanted to be a part of what he's making happen in the city.
And what is the role of local government in the arts in the city as you see it, or indeed as the mayor sees it?
Well, I think it's a really multifaceted role. I think certainly there's a piece of it that is about, you know, finding a place for city support for cultural organizations, but it has to be so much more than that. It's really about making the sort of engine of city government work on behalf of arts and culture, looking at what are the opportunities to help make arts and culture thrive by bringing together all the different assets of the city, looking at things like zoning and urban planning and transportation and parks and recreation, schools. I mean, there are all those different pieces that are really part of a thriving arts sector. And those are pieces not even within my department here, but part of other aspects of city government. So I think a really important part of my work is going to be, one, doing an inventory of everything that's happening already within city government. Because this office has not existed for many years, I think there's been a sort of loss of cohesion in that work. And another major piece is then, frankly, becoming an advocate for all the things that the city already does for the arts, but then, frankly, becoming an advocate for the city and for the arts sector with the private sector, with the larger national world, international world, because I think there's already so much extraordinary work happening here and a story to tell that's really not being told.
A lot of the time when you talk to local politicians about art and the arts, they tend to use one of two phrases, either engine for economic development or tourism. You've used neither phrase in the last few minutes.
Well, I certainly think it has both those
That wasn't a criticism.
Those assets. No, I think it's important. One of the things that I think we've focused on a lot, frankly, in our desperation to find a rationale or justification for art, is to look at the economic justification and to look at what it does for tourism, to look at what it does for economic impact, for attraction and retention of workers, attraction and retention of businesses. And all of those things are absolutely critical, and they're all true. And I think our challenge now in the arts is to sort of combine those, what we sometimes call instrumental values, with the intrinsic values, and to not forget the fact that the arts make us better people, they make us happier in our lives, they help us understand other cultures. And frankly, there's an increasing recognition that having the arts as part of your life and as part of your education makes you a better worker, because it gives you the kinds of applied skills that actually make you a better person too. The arts also increase civic engagement. People that are engaged in the arts are people that are more likely to be engaged at work. They're people that are more likely to vote. They're people that are more likely to serve on a local board, to get involved in their neighborhood. So I think it's all interrelated. And I think it's not that the economic impact arguments and cultural tourism arguments are not important. They're just kind of two arrows in a quiver that contains many more arrows.
You mentioned education, and it's been a criticism of the City of Philadelphia and the School Reform Board that arts education was the easiest thing to lose. What's this administration's attitude to reinstating significantly arts education in the public school system?
Well, I can't really speak for the education policy of the administration, but I can say that I know that there's very strong support for arts and culture as being a critical component of a complete education for the children in this school system. And I'm sure the mayor will support everything possible to achieve those goals within, obviously, all the limitations that one always has to deal with. But I think it's clear that this mayor really has a commitment to having arts and culture be back in the school system, and it's going to be a long process. And I think many school systems now are grappling with the fact that they recognize that having the arts in the schools actually ultimately ends up improving academic performance. And it also, as I said, educates young people in a way that makes them better human beings and ultimately more employable in a 21st century workforce in ways that aren't directly related to scores. It sort of gets back to your reference to my not mentioning cultural tourism. I think we've often focused on the role that arts education plays in boosting test scores. And I think there's a lot of research that's come out recently that has kind of questioned that. And that's gotten a lot of play. But what hasn't been focused on as much is the fact that there are many, many ways in which the arts have been proven to improve long-term a young person's school experience. And even if it's not reflected necessarily in an SAT score, it's reflected in a reduction in truancy and absenteeism. Because if that kid's engaged in band and there's band practice that day, they're going to come to school. And they may still suffer through their classes, but they'll get the degree because to play in the band, they have to stay in school. And they'll learn teamwork, and they'll learn how to work with other people, they'll learn about other cultures. There are all sorts of things that they'll acquire in the course of their arts education that, even if they can't be measured in terms of test scores, still affect them as a human being.
Gary Stoyer, the Chief Cultural Officer and Director of the City of Philadelphia's Office of Arts, Culture, and the Creative Economy.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
While many of Beethoven's masterpieces demand respect, devotion, and even subjugation, his only opera, Fidelio, asks for help. That's one reason the piece has been absent from the Opera Company of Philadelphia's seasons for the past 19 years. In the works for 3 years, a new $2 million production that opens Friday was contingent not on finding the right singers, but solutions to theatrical problems. Addressing that, painter and sculptor June Kaniko transplants the story of a woman rescuing her long-imprisoned husband into a high-style netherworld of imagery and symbolism, as the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns now reports.
It's funny, it's not turquoise and it's not royal, and even the dyer.
The question you don't hear backstage at the new production of Fidelio is why? Any answer is likely to be evasive or provisional from Jun Kaneko, the Japan-born, Omaha-based artist whose work is now exhibited at the Lux Gallery in Philadelphia and all along Park Avenue in New York City. On Tuesday, at an Academy of Music dressing room, costumer Richard St. Clair was getting the right shade of blue on the correct sleeve of an asymmetrically colored dotted outfit that soprano Eileen Perez will wear in the role of Marcelina.
I don't know. I don't think there's no answer about this is right or wrong. It's just purely intuitive taste, and, you know, you just say, yeah, that's it.
Kaneko explains why. Well, sort of.
Oh, this is great, but you say, well, maybe it's a different taste, you know.
You have to ask how fabrics could possibly change the way soprano Perez plays the straightforward role of a jailer's daughter. But it does.
For me, the costumes always dictate and inform the character on stage. Everything is very clean, and I think it informs my character a lot, and I'm enjoying, I can't wait to see the real shoes and to feel what they're going to be like on the rake and on the stage.
Virtually nothing about Beethoven or his music would suggest that such attention to exteriors would matter. His music is often the antithesis of sensuality, and with Fidelio, Beethoven struggled over many years, as deeply as he believed in the opera's humanitarian ideals. Giving them faces and names and putting them into a plot wasn't something his muse always accommodated. Clearly, Beethoven was in alien territory. Though his compositional process was always full of false starts and revisions, Beethoven seemed not to know when the start in Fidelio was a false one until it was all finished and orchestrated. That's one explanation why he wrote four overtures, two of which are rambling and full of musical blind alleys. If there's one thing that Beethoven does indisputably well in this opera, it's to convey the utter hopelessness of a political prisoner. He has been virtually buried alive in the deepest recesses of the prison, seen only by jailers who are the most obedient, ask the fewest questions, and can cope with feeding him less and less every day. Opera Company of Philadelphia music director Corrado Roveras talks about how Beethoven's notes and orchestration take one's ears to such an almost unimaginably bleak place.
Step by step, you go dark and dark, and you go in the prison, and you change completely in the orchestration. You change, and so you have to find another sound, another approach, where the orchestration, you have this darkness with these waves in the bass section with the contrabassoon, and you think that you are hopeless.
The less Fidelio has to do with a particular time and place, since its story could happen anywhere, anytime that political prisoners are held without fair trial, the more likely its timeless message will float to the surface. Jun Kaneko's visual language, however, isn't an obvious choice for the opera. It's colorful, ebullient. His dumpling-shaped sculptures on Park Avenue aren't exactly menacing. Nonetheless, his responses to the darker parts of Fidelio most excite Opera Company of Philadelphia's artistic director, Robert Driver.
This was something that Jun came up with that I just feel captures how he internalized the music here. We'll have this huge screen in front, you know, instead of a curtain, during the second act, introduction to the second act. But, for example, you just see this grid work, the prison symbol, and you see these dots of color. And the first dot is a red one. And then the dots descend like this, and it becomes very colorful. And then that goes into total darkness.
The production may well be seen outside Philadelphia. Kaneko's Madame Butterfly has been produced in several cities so far, and impresarios from many opera companies will be in Philadelphia for Fidelio. Regardless of its success, Kaneko claims to have no interest in following in the footsteps of painter David Hockney by pursuing a second career in opera design. Even the applause, he says, feels a bit awkward. But only a bit.
But it's something, though. Here, 2,500 seat, that many people come. And it's a really interesting condensed energy.
Sounds to me like the beginning of a theater addiction.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. He writes about the Dalio in tomorrow's paper. All of the excerpts in that piece come from a Deutsche Grammophon recording of the Vienna State Opera conducted by Leonard Bernstein. The Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Fidelio opens Friday and runs through October 24th. Born in 1883, the American painter Charles DeMuth generated about 1,000 works over the course of his lifetime. Yet while long recognized as a master watercolorist, his name has never carried much star power in his hometown of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. But since his death in 1935, that's been slowly changing. Now, as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, a foundation and museum in downtown Lancaster continues to celebrate the life and works of this innovative painter.
The DeMuth Foundation and Museum was founded by the now 94-year-old Jerry Less, a former local journalist and longtime Lancaster resident. Less says he became conscious of the work of Charles DeMuth in the mid-1930s, while a student at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School.
I used to read Vanity Fair and a couple of other magazines of that type, and he was featured as a national, at that time, known artist. And it occurred to me that nobody in Lancaster knew about this man who was known throughout the country.
When he later moved back to Lancaster, Less found there were no DeMuth paintings on public exhibition anywhere in town. For years, this bothered Less, so in the early 1980s, he spearheaded an initiative to raise funds for the creation of a dedicated DeMuth Museum. The first order of business was purchasing one of the oldest buildings in Lancaster, the artist's King Street home and studio, where DeMuth lived for most of his life and died. This became the museum's home. In the beginning, Less says the foundation did not own any DeMuth artwork, but the donations soon came.
My wife at that time, Margaret, gave Charles's self-portrait, which she had bought at an auction sale for $2. So that gives you some idea of Lancaster's knowledge and respect for Charles the painter.
Any idea why that would be the case? That you mentioned that there was a little reluctance or lack of enthusiasm.
When he lived in Lancaster, he was more or less a recluse. He had a few favored friends, but he did not circulate. His illness contributed to that.
DeMuth's health was perpetually frail. As a child, he suffered from lameness, and as an adult, from severe diabetes. But this didn't stifle his creativity, which his family recognized early on. They hired teachers to help nurture his artistic talent, and had the means to do so with a successful family business. Standing alongside the DeMuth home, the DeMuth Tobacco Shop was, and still is, a popular institution in Lancaster City. Started in 1770, it's the oldest operating tobacco shop in the country. As DeMuth grew older, he received training in Philadelphia at the Drexel Institute of Art, Science, and Industry and at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. He also traveled extensively, which enabled him to foster friendships with early 20th century luminaries like Georgia O'Keeffe, Marcel Duchamp, Gertrude Stein, and Eugene O'Neill. DeMuth Museum Executive Director Ann Lampe says these experiences helped shape DeMuth's artistic vision.
He lived in Lancaster all his life, but traveled in very avant-garde intellectual circles in Philadelphia, New York, London, Paris. He took the most avant-garde ideas of the day, and they were emanating out of Europe, and brought them back to America and applied them to the subject matter of Lancaster and everything he found here.
DeMuth is known for his skillful and imaginative use of watercolors, especially his paintings of flowers from his mother's garden, which he could see from his second-floor studio. DeMuth Museum visitors can explore both the restored garden with its original brickwork and DeMuth's studio space in which he spent so much time.
Today you can still see the tile in the gallery, but he came through the bathroom and back in here to his studio, and he was secluded. It had three windows so he could look out into his mother's garden and the Trinity.
DeMuth is also known for being at the forefront of developing a style of painting known as Precisionism, an art movement strongly influenced by Cubism, and often focusing on the industrialization and modernization of the American landscape. For instance, Anne Lampe says DeMuth would take something very commonplace, like a flower.
And he would create planes and lines. If you know Picasso's cubism, how he creates planes out of everything. And so cutting things into planes and different forms, which are called rays. So it sort of looks like light coming through a stained glass window, cutting across a picture.
Two of DeMuth's most well-regarded paintings were created in this style, the descriptively titled Figure 5 in gold, and My Egypt, which in particular reflects the inspiration that the city of Lancaster provided for DeMuth. The 1927 painting features two once prominent grain towers in downtown Lancaster. Other paintings feature the city's Lutheran church steeple, a feed mill sign, a water tower, and chimneys. Anne Lampe says works like these synthesized what was going on in America at the time.
Here in Lancaster, we forget what a bustling city this was, with the trolleys and the streetcars going up and down and the electricity wires were coming. But yet you could go a half mile and you were in a farm. So he was really exploring this transition in American society between an agrarian culture and becoming an industrialized culture.
Lampe says this exploration made him a leader of early American modernist art, a painter that influenced artists to come, pop artists like Andy Warhol and Robert Indiana. Tom Cook, a Lancaster-based art collector and enthusiast, says in paintings like My Egypt at the Whitney Museum, DeMuth taught so many how to look at mundane things in a fresh way.
The grain towers that were mentioned, I went to the Whitney and I was blown away by his imaging of, you know, things that I took for granted that I drove by every day. And I think that an artist can show us how to see something in a totally new and different light.
Due to the widespread reverence for DeMuth's work today, many of his well-known pieces are on display in galleries and museums outside of Lancaster. But that's not to say that the DeMuth Museum collection is unimportant. With 32 DeMuth pieces, only the Barnes Foundation in Marion, PA, and the Museum of Modern Art in New York feature more of his works. Even so, the strength of the museum in Lancaster is the opportunity to see the house DeMuth called home, the studio in which he created, and the buildings and garden that provided so much inspiration for his paintings. With the Foundation's historical artifacts, library archives, and art collection, DeMuth Museum leaders want to continue developing the institution into being what they call DeMuth Central, a must-see destination for any serious student and admirer of Charles DeMuth. The old adage of the prophet being honored anywhere but in his hometown may at one time have been appropriate for Lancaster, but now the Foundation and Museum that bears his name is helping to ensure that Charles DeMuth is remembered and revered where he was born, lived, and died.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. One family name spans three generations of Philadelphia's artistic heritage, and the three Calders, all named Alexander, have left their own individual marks on the city. Alexander Milne Calder, who crafted over 200 figures for City Hall, including his iconic bronze sculpture of William Penn on top, his son Alexander Sterling Calder, whose sculptures adorn Swan Memorial Fountain on Logan Circle and other parts of the city, and his son, Alexander Calder, inventor of the mobile, whose work Ghost hangs in the Great Stair Hall of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to an exhibition that shows another side to the grandson in this remarkable lineage.
The first work of art in the show of Calder jewelry at the Philadelphia Museum of Art is a necklace of curling ribbons of hammered brass. Seemingly suspended in space, it drapes across an invisible wearer, over unseen shoulders, down an imagined back. Alone in the rotunda, like a hostess at the door, it invites us into the light-filled gallery beyond. This is jewelry, but not in the ordinary sense.
It's really about body ornamentation. This is not jewelry in the refined, sort of dainty sense.
Elizabeth Agro is the museum's associate curator for modern and contemporary craft and decorative arts.
This is about sculpture. Sculpture for the body.
Coming from a family of artists, Alexander Calder first tried another direction. Drawn to mechanics and engineering, he graduated from Stevens Institute of Technology in 1919, but he turned to painting and sculpting, first in New York, then in Paris in the 1920s, where he mingled with surrealist, experimental, and modernist artists of the time. The creative impulse, says curator of American art Kathleen Foster, was in his bones.
He just grew up with all of this legacy of sculpture. He couldn't help it. He was making stuff out of everyday objects and scraps and jewelry for his wife and so forth. It's a kind of natural art making that I think really characterizes his outlook.
While his father and grandfather sculpted classical figures, carving in stone and casting in bronze, Calder experimented with color, shape, subject, and movement, using wire, glass, and other found materials. He gained fame from his Calder Circus, a miniature reproduction of a circus made from these ordinary materials, which he displayed and performed by making his circus figures move. Then Calder lifted sculpture into the air and made it move. The creations for which he would become best known were his abstract sculptures that suspended, moved in the air, described as mobiles by the French artist Marcel Duchamp. Calder would sometimes mount a sculpture or mobile atop a stabile, which was another sculpture made out of sheet metal fixed to the ground. Jewelry, though, may have been where it all began.
He began making jewelry when he was a child for his sister's dolls, so clearly he was amused by the idea of body adornment.
Alexander Rohrer, Calder's grandson and director of the Calder Foundation, says Calder made jewelry in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s as both a means of expression and a way to make money. Each of the over 1,800 works he created during his lifetime was one of a kind. They expressed, says Rohrer, a sensibility that was anti-pretentious.
He presented his jewelry and he invited you to participate in his kind of utopian ideals of attitudes about value and attitudes about beauty and attitudes about adornment, and all those things were very unusual. I mean, these aren't diamond necklaces, you know?
And this exhibition of about 100 necklaces, bracelets, brooches, earrings, crowns, and tiaras feels more like a show of small sculptures than a trip through Tiffany's. Pieces are made from wire, hammered metal, and shards of glass and ceramics, attached by an African technique of stapling instead of soldering. Calder was, in some ways, a product of his time, say Elizabeth Agro and Kathleen Foster.
The artists of the early 20th century were very excited by revitalizing Western art with the abstraction that they saw in world cultures, and I see this in Calder's work.
He's looking at floral forms, he's looking at ancient motifs like the spiral, inferencing pre-Columbian art and jewelry, and also African art and jewelry as well.
The first part of the show highlights jewelry he made for his wife, Louisa James, whom he first spotted in 1929 on the deck of an ocean liner.
He saw her with all her hair all completely ringleted up. It was a lot of ringlets on an ocean liner. It's very moist. And she looked like Medusa. So he made this bracelet that spells out Medusa. And it sort of forecasts the amazing jewelry he would be making for the future for her, but also for other people and through his exhibitions and such.
Another section explores how he showed and sold his jewelry, and there are photographs of celebrities like Georgia O'Keeffe and Peggy Guggenheim wearing his work. The necklaces in particular are large and ornamental. Some have moving parts like tiny mobiles. All have personality, but perhaps none more so than the jealous husband necklace displayed and shown in a photograph on Angelica Houston.
It's just what it sounds like. It's this incredible necklace, very tour de force, with a lot of cantilevered swirls with daggers hanging out of it. So if you were to hug this woman, you would be poked in the eye.
This show reveals a personal side of an artist, much of whose work is more public. Alexander Calder is like and unlike his famous father and grandfather, says Kathleen Foster.
All of them, in a way, are very interested in public art, and I think Calder grew into that, coming out of his background as an engineer and a kind of playful sense of art as part of daily life. And I think Calder carries that tradition through in a very abstract and modern vocabulary.
The challenge of a show like this is that a piece of Calder jewelry is an artistic expression made complete by the wearer, who then becomes part of the art. But this jewelry is so evocative as art, it also stands on its own, piquing curiosity, engaging the imagination, and providing insight into an artist integral to the continuing story of Philadelphia art.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Calder Jewelry is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art's Perelman Building until November 2nd. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.